Whereas offences against property have of late increased in and near the metropolis, and the local establishments of nightly watch and nightly police having been found inadequate to the prevention and detection of crime, and whereas it is expedient to substitute a new and more efficient system of police in lieu of such...
Peeler by Patrick Carroll. Episode 3.
Oh, Mr. Peel, what have you done? Your police act so grand, sir. It will be the cause, I have no doubt, of filling Van Diemen's land, sir. London now, believe me, sir, is overstruck with queer codes. Who wish the police act and you were sent to Jimmy Square Toes.
Constable Quinn. Are you familiar with the booklet which I hold in my hand?
Yes, sir, I am. It is the handbook...
Pray silence, Constable. I did not ask you what it was. I inquired if you were familiar with it. For the information of the court, I will identify the booklet in question. It is the Handbook of General Instructions, which is, I believe, issued to all ranks of the new Metropolitan Police upon the assumption of their duties.
I have read the document in question. It is, in my view, an infamous document, containing pernicious and mischievous instructions to a force that is dubious in its constitutionality and held by many respectable people to be entirely un-English. However, it is not Sir Robert Peel's police force which is on trial here.
Indeed not, Mr. Rowe. Constable Quinn, you say you are familiar with the booklet. How familiar?
If I may say so, without presumption, I believe I could undertake to recite passages of it from memory.
Indeed. Are you equally acquainted with the passage from the section headed Police Constables, which states, he will be civil and attentive to persons of every rank and class?
I am, sir. The sentence, if the bench will permit me, the sentence continues, insolence and incivility will not be passed over.
That is correct, Constable. Do you wish the court to understand that in your judgment it is respectful and civil to crack a man's head open with a staff?
Of course I do not. I was merely...
Who is you? He must be particularly cautious not to interfere idly and unnecessarily. Do you consider that on the occasion which concerns us, you followed that instruction?
The gentleman will recall that at the time of the incident, large and unruly crowds were gathered in the vicinity of the Houses of Parliament. I felt it necessary, in order to fulfil my instructions, to halt the carriage driven by Mr. Squires. And I will again add, if the court permits, that the instruction quoted by counsel goes on to say, when required to act, he will do so with decision and boldness.
Decision and boldness, indeed! To strike an unarmed man a blow with a staff which well nigh killed him!
I considered myself at the time to be acting entirely in self-defense.
Self-defense? With the court's indulgence, I will read out one last excerpt from the section of the handbook addressed to police constables.
By all means.
He must remember that there is no qualification more indispensable to a police officer than a perfect command of temper. Never suffering himself to be moved in the slightest degree by any language or threats that may be used. If he do his duty in a quiet and determined manner, such conduct will induce well-disposed bystanders to assist him should he require it. On this occasion, was your conduct such that it induced well-disposed bystanders to assist you?
No, sir.
And why was that, Constable?
Because, sir, there were no bystanders near enough.
What? In all those throngs of people?
No well-disposed bystanders.
Oh, come now, Constable. What of his lordship's footmen?
I did not consider them to be bystanders. They were, in fact, joined in the attack against me.
Oh?
It was that circumstance which led me to draw my staff.
Had you no colleague?
None immediately to hand, and those nearest were very hardly pressed by the crowd.
And Mr. Squire's master, Lord Troll, did he not attempt to assist you in your duty of maintaining the public order?
Indeed he did not, sir. He urged his servants on to assault me.
No. Constable! You are surely mistaken.
I regret to say I am not, sir. His lordship's words, as I had reason to recall to my superiors, were, thrash him, kill him, a guinea to the man who brings them down.
you remember hearing distinctly all of that speech in the thick of a melee?
Yes, sir, they were cried out very loudly by his lordship almost before a blow was struck.
That is your contention, Constable?
Yes, sir.
The bench will allow me to advise that we shall return to this point at a later stage.
As you wish, Brother Caslett.
One last question, Constable. Do you consider yourself a hot-tempered man?
Why, no, sir. No, not unusually so.
Not unusually, sir. Thank you, Constable. That will be all for the present.
Why, what is it? What has occurred?
They are out, sir. Defeated by 29 votes on the Chancellor's civil list motion. The ministry is defeated. Wellington must resign and Peel with him.
I felt it my duty to wait upon the King, and humbly and respectfully to inform His Majesty that I perceive it is no longer in my power to undertake the administration of public affairs, either with satisfaction to my own feelings or with perfect advantage to the country. Sir, His Majesty has been graciously pleased to accept the resignation thus tendered on my part.
Ah, Mr. Reed, punctual to your time as usual. I observe that you are not alone, Mr. Reed.
A thousand apologies, Mrs. Gascoigne, but this gentleman was most insistent that I introduce him.
Indeed. And who is the extremely insistent gentleman?
Jeremiah Morley, ma'am, at your service.
Mr. Morley of Bow Street.
I cannot conceive in what way Mr. Morley could possibly hope to profit from an interview with me. I recollect that I tried to convey as much to the gentleman when he addressed himself to me not long ago.
You do yourself an injustice, ma'am. No man could fail to profit from the privilege of your society. And conversation?
Hmm? How very gallant. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure you are quite mistaken, sir. Mr. Morley of Bow Street is, or so I am told, a considerable public figure, deeply immersed in the great tide of events and affairs. While I, as one can see, am quite retired here from the world and society.
Again, you are too modest, ma'am. The name of Mrs. Gascoigne is a byword for everything, of course, that is elegant and refined.
Am I not right, Screever?
Really, Mr. Morley, how am I to reply?
I am sure you will allow Mr. Reed to excuse himself. While you, sir, explain the purpose of your visit.
That will be unnecessary, Mrs. Gascoigne. Mr. Reed's place is here. And whatever else may be said of Mr. Reed, he always knows his place.
I hope I do, Mr. Morley.
Ma'am, you are acquainted with Mrs. Abrahams, widow of Mr. Joseph Abrahams, late of Ely Place, Charterhouse Street?
Am I, sir?
Come, Mrs. Gascoigne. The lady's been observed coming to and going from this house on more than one occasion.
Indeed. And how does so respectable-sounding a lady come to have her movements noted by an officer of Bow Street?
By conducting herself in such a manner as to become the object of deepest concern to her family.
What has such conduct to do with me, pray?
That is what I'm anxious to discover. Be so good as to tell me what purposes Mrs. Abraham's visits to this house. Come, ma'am, I will know at the last.
Why, sir, as I'm sure you are aware, I am myself a widowed lady. The late Mr. Gascoigne did not die a rich man. In order, therefore, to eke out my very meager resources, I have allowed myself to become available for a modest fee to certain respectable ladies as an advisor in matters of personal health and toilette.
Indeed, ma'am.
Yes, sir. Mm. I trust I do not flatter myself when I say that I have acquired an extensive knowledge and perfected divers techniques which allow me to help ladies who are, like myself, past the first blush, to retain and enhance those gifts which nature bestows in youth and sadly repossesses as we grow older.
A useful and highly altruistic occupation, ma'am. I do not doubt that you bring great comfort to those ladies who avail themselves of your ministrations.
And to their husbands, eh?
Quite so, Mr. Reed. But as Mr. Morley tells us, Mrs. Abrahams has no husband.
Well, true, she has not. Had she, the circumstances would be more distressing to a family than they are even now.
What circumstances, Mr. Morley, if I may inquire?
Those of a lady being the receipt of several letters from a young gentleman of title, letters so ardent and indecorous in their language that, referring as they do to an entirely unacknowledged intimacy, they must compromise the lady in the most serious manner.
Sir, while I admit to some slight professional acquaintance with Mrs. Abrahams, I fail to see what the lady's correspondence, however regrettable, has to do with me.
Mrs. Gascoigne, those letters are addressed in care of this house.
I can hardly be held responsible for that.
Ma'am, those letters refer to you personally, in terms which imply your knowledge of, nay, your complicity in the liaison.
You are ridiculous, sir. Entirely absurd.
And those letters, despite bearing the signature of another name, were in fact written by our friend Mr. Reed. Am I not right, Screever?
Really, Mr. Morley, I've already explained that I undertook the copying of those letters as a favour.
And I ask you again, Screever, a favour for whom? For Mrs. Gascoigne?
Not for me, Mr. Morley, most decidedly not for me.
I cannot say, Mr. Morley.
Sir, I assure you that I am entirely ignorant of any letters to or from Mrs. Abrahams. I know nothing of their contents or provenance. And now I must ask you to leave me.
As you wish, ma'am. With no provable facts in contradiction, I must naturally accept your assertion.
That is a mercy at the least.
However, I do not scruple to say that I shall be continuing in the matter, and that it may be necessary for me to wait upon you again, ma'am. I trust I shall encounter no obstacles should the occasion arise.
Most assuredly not, Mr. Morley. Good day.
Extraordinarily handsome and elegant woman, Screever.
Oh, very, yes, sir.
Everything about the lady evinces the most perfectly refined taste. I particularly admired the very fine cameo brooch she wore at her bosom.
The brooch? The brooch, to be sure.
Very fine. I doubt one could find its duplicate in all of London.
Now, Mr. Jenkins, will you tell the court, did Constable Quinn actually strike you on the occasion you have described?
Why, no, sir. Not just to say actually struck me with his fist, but he did give me a good hard shove.
And did you retaliate against this good hard shove?
Why, no, sir. I did not.
Why not, Mr. Jenkins?
Martin Quinn is half a foot taller than what I am, and 3 stone heavier if he's an ounce. I'm not a craven man, I hope, sir, but I'm no chucklehead neither.
Silence! Brother Caslett, if you have concluded, perhaps you will permit me...
By all means, Mr. Rowe.
Constable Quinn, as you are unrepresented, do you wish the bench to ask witness any questions?
Oh, yes, sir. You might ask Mr. Jenkins how much he'd had to drink the morning he's spoken of, what damage he did to our section house that day, and what terms of threatening abuse he used to me before I pushed him away.
Mr. Jenkins?
If Constable Quinn is saying I was drunk that day, I deny it. And the only damage I recall doing was to break the chair I fell upon when he knocked me over.
And the terms of threatening abuse?
I never threatened him. I warned him that I wouldn't be used by him the same way as he used old John Staples. No, not if he was twice my size.
And who, pray, is John Staples?
Why, his old master in the coopering. Some 12 months ago, before he became Constable Quinn, he'd give John Staples such a thrashing as put the poor old man in his bed for a week.
Is this true, Constable? Come, Constable, speak out.
The truth of the matter is that I did come to blows with my former master. But as anyone acquainted with us both will tell you, he struck first, and the contest was even enough.
I see. And is there any other point you would like put, Constable?
If you please, Mr. Rowe, I can see that what's mainly between Mr. Jenkins and myself comes down to his word against mine.
True, Constable.
In that case, I would like the court to be aware of 2 facts which may be confirmed by the official records of the Metropolitan Police.
And those are?
Mr. Jenkins has said that the events in question occurred on 4th September last. Would he tell the court on what date he was dismissed from the police and for what cause?
Mr. Jenkins?
I was dismissed on the 5th of September.
What for, Mr. Jenkins?
Silence, Constable! Why were you dismissed, Mr. Jenkins?
It were,
Speak out, please, Mr. Jenkins. I cannot hear you.
For drunkenness on duty and gross misconduct.
Forgive me if I'm mistaken, Sir Robert, but surely you have rehung some of your pictures since I last had the pleasure of visiting this most delightful of rooms.
Your observation is accurate, Mr. Mayne. There has been some rearrangement. Obema Chateau de Brederode. Very fine, is it not, Colonel?
Well, as you must know, Sir Robert, I am next billet to a blind man in the presence of fine art, but even I must recognize its quality, as I also note the absence of many of the late Sir Thomas Lawrence's portraits, which I have seen here previously.
Yes, I've had the bulk of them removed to Drayton. Since my father's death, I am, of course, obliged to spend more time there. Poor Lawrence. His own death appears to me to have been a dark ill omen, posted at the gateway of this most melancholy year.
I think that none of us will be unduly saddened to see the passing of the present year.
That is certainly true for my part. Sir Thomas in January, my father in May. And, of course, I'm Mr. Peel. I should have soon as expected to see a pig in church as you at a race. Of course, that was just at the time when our metropolitan release measure awaited the royal assent, and His Majesty was quite loath to bestow it.
Yes, he was not, I believe, a staunch supporter of the new police.
Indeed not, Colonel. Do you recall the occasion upon which His Majesty personally congratulated the manager of the Theatre Royal for not permitting our constables upon the premises?
Yes, right.
He was undoubtedly a dyed-in-the-wool ultra in that respect. And yet, despite our differences, I am happy in the recollection of a most affecting interview which I had with him not long before his own death. And we parted, I think, on the best terms of our entire acquaintance.
I will take the liberty, Sir Robert, of hoping that we may say the same of our three selves, although our present leave-taking is a purely professional.
For my part, Colonel, I say so most heartily. Scarcely a day has passed during the months of our professional intercourse, gentlemen, that I have not counted myself and the public singularly fortunate in our choice of commissioners.
It is very kind of you to say so, Sir Robert.
It is seldom in public life that the country receives so great a deal more from its servants than even the most demanding master could expect. You, if I may say so, gentlemen, represent such an exception to the general level of expectation.
Oh, come, surely we've done no more from our duty, Sir Robert.
Perhaps it is the extreme fatigue induced in me by the crisis and dramas of these past weeks which turns me so unwontedly fulsome. But if Mr. Mayne will permit my saying so, in your own case particularly, Colonel, it is surely a bonus to find such a genius for patience and diplomacy in a professional military man. Tact in an old soldier, much like beauty in one's aunts, is pleasant to find, but not necessarily to be expected.
Oh, really, my dear sir, you say too much.
At all events, Sir Robert, I hope you may, for the moment at least, leave the conduct of your creation in our hands with not too many misgivings.
I am entirely confident that it could be in no better.
It had been our intention at this time to call upon Mr. Squires to testify in his own defense. However, as every person present may observe, Mr. Squires remains...
Beautifully got up, isn't he, Sergeant? The bloodstain on a bandage is an inspiration.
Mr. Morning, I did not expect to see you here.
Silence in the court!
Oh, my apologies, Mr. Rowe. I was forgetting myself.
Well, good day, Mr. Morley.
Good day, sir.
I must observe that you, of all people, should know how to conduct himself in a magistrate's office.
Your pardon, Mr. Rowe, sir. My pledge, it shan't happen again.
I trust not. Pray continue, Brother Cazalet.
Thank you, Mr. Rowe. The court will be pleased to learn that although Mr. Squire's condition precludes his testifying in person, his employer, himself a witness to this atrocious assault, has graciously agreed to appear upon his servant's behalf. I call upon his lordship, Viscount Trowe.
Oh, don't they love a lord?
I hope the bench doesn't love him too much, or Quinn's a goner.
Silence! Silence in the court! My lord, the court is honored by your extreme condescension in appearing in what must, among your lordship's many concerns, seem a comparatively trivial matter.
Indeed, sir. I feel it no less than my duty to do all in my power to ensure that my most vilely used servant receives justice.
It scarcely seems necessary in your lordship's case, but if you would be so kind, the book...
My dear sir, I would insist if you did not.
Take the book in your right hand. Do you swear that the evidence you are about to give is the truth and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
My lord, Would you be so good as to describe for the court the incident in question, which took place in Whitehall on the afternoon of 3rd November last?
Indeed, sir. It is quickly told. Upon being driven along Whitehall toward the Houses of Parliament, my carriage was abruptly halted near Downing Street. Seeing no reason why this should have been so, I ordered my coachman to drive on. When, after some moments, he had not done so, I looked out only to see him being beaten with a staff by the defendant.
I beg your pardon, my lord. Constable Quinn is not the defendant in this case.
Upon my soul, he ought to be.
Be that as it may, my lord. Was there anyone else involved in the fracas? Your lordship's footman, for instance?
I observed my footman, faithful fellows, just coming to their comrade's assistance.
Did you, my lord, make any effort to interfere?
Not bodily, sir. It is hardly the act of a gentleman to involve himself in a street brawl. I have no doubt that I did call out to my footman that they try and stop the constable's violence towards squires.
Ah, now, my lord. Constable Quinn has told the court that, so far from attempting to quell the disturbance, indeed when scarcely a blow had been struck, you cried out to your servants, "Thrash him, kill him, a guinea to the man who brings him down."
It is a black lie, sir. At the very least, a monstrous perversion of the facts. It is true that in the heat of the moment, seeing my servant so ill-used, I called to the other to thrash him, culp him.
Culp? I beg your lordship's pardon, but I am unfamiliar with that word.
If I might explain, Mr. Rowe, that the word means to smite or beat. Its use by a gentleman of Lord Troll's position may be regarded as somewhat of a solecism, but it is common usage among the vulgar. Derived, I believe, from the Popish habit of thumping the chest during confession, in conjunction with the Latin phrase, mea culpa.
I see. Thank you, Brother Caslin.
Mr. Rowe.
Pray continue.
My lord. My lord, it is conceivable that the word culp might be misheard as kill, but the offer of a guinea is not so easily mistaken.
As to that, sir, I deny it entirely and emphatically.
Yes. Constable Quinn. And do you still contend that those were the words spoken by his lordship?
I do.
Are you able to produce any other person who will testify to having heard them?
I cannot. I have inquired among my brother officers, but none is able conscientiously to say that he was near enough to have heard his lordship distinctly.
Indeed. Mr. Rowe, I will inform the court that Lord Troll's footmen are both prepared to attest that they never heard the words in question. And further, that the defendant would also be anxious too, so attest were his condition such as to permit it.
I will take that in consideration, Brother Cazalet.
I desire to ask your lordship one more question. Were you not shocked at the occurrences we have been discussing?
Shocked, sir? No. Dismayed, horrified, appalled, yes. But shocked? No. It was my first impression, and it has become my considered opinion, that Constable Quinn, like most of his colleagues, is little more than a common ruffian.
Mr. Rowe, on behalf of my brother officers, I protest.
Silence, Constable! While I would not go so far as your lordship in so general a view, I cannot deny that my observation has been that, upon the whole, the new police do not attract a particularly superior sort of man, even considering the classes from which they are largely recruited. However, that is not our concern at present. Gentlemen, I will adjourn for dinner, after which cases may be summed up.
The truth, Mr. Quinn. Would you not at the moment positively welcome odds against you of only 3-1?
Oh, I do not, God knows, see many friendly faces in Mr. Rowe's office.
I held the magistrate's conduct of the proceedings to be shocking. His prejudice against
the matter of Lord Trowell and what words he did or did not say.
Surely, one or another of your brother officers could have been prevailed upon to swear to what they must be morally certain was said, even if they did not actually hear it being said.
Such a notion could not be entertained under any circumstances, not by myself at any rate, and most certainly not by the commissioners.
Never, however tempting such a recourse might seem. Should Colonel Rowan or Mr. Main receive even a hint of such a proceeding, as they most certainly would, every man implicated would be summarily dismissed.
Well, if fire is not to be fought with fire, Mr. Quinn, I fear your fate has now passed entirely out of your own hands.
In addition to the plain facts placed so convincingly before us by his lordship and others in regard to the events of this case, I would also remind the court of what we have heard respecting the character of the plaintiff, Constable Quinn.
The same Constable Quinn, you will recall, who does not consider himself an unusually hot-tempered man, but who nonetheless has been obliged to admit inflicting violence upon a former colleague and to vicious brawling with his master of 11 years. It is on those facts and those revelations concerning his accuser that I rest the defense of Mr. Squires.
Oh, do not stop, please, cousin. The air is so very melancholy as to be quite exhilarating.
Yes, that is why I stopped.
Oh, how very strange you are. Come, there is a little sun at last. Let us walk in the garden for a while. Or would you prefer your book?
No, neither. Nothing. I left off my book because it made me angry.
You have much admired works by the same lady in the past.
The heroine was coming to disgust me. The author holds up for admiration behavior in her which seems to me so spineless, so lacking in character, and so unnaturally selfless as to be grotesque and absurd.
Oh, Maria, you exaggerate so. Is selflessness grotesque or absurd in a woman? It is the greatest virtue, surely.
Virtue? If it is a virtue, it is not mine. And to whom would I display such a virtue if I possessed it? My father?
Why, to him, naturally.
It is not so. I do as he dictates because I am mortally afraid of him. In my mind, I am not obedient to him. In my soul, I am not dutiful toward him. In my heart, I am not meek and loving toward him. In my real heart, I believe I have come to hate him.
You cannot say so, Maria. Your father?
I am sorry, cousin. I have no wish to make you wretched or so. Come, kiss me. And we shall walk in the garden.
Yes, it will lighten your spirits, Maria, I'm sure. Yes, Lucy?
Excuse me, miss, but a letter's come for Miss Staples.
Oh, for me?
From your father, no doubt.
Well, thank you, Lucy.
No, father will never write to anyone except in the way of business.
Could it possibly be
from Martin? It would as likely be from the Emperor of China.
Who? Why, it is from Mr. Lytton, our curate, but why would he... Maria, what is it? What is it? What does Mr. Lytton say?
Oh, dear God. I must return to London at once.
But my dearest cousin, why? What is it?
My poor, darling Martin. He is sent to prison.
That was episode 3 of Peeler by Patrick Carroll, with Mick Ford as Martin Quinn and James Booth as Jeremiah Morley. Richard E. Grant was Lord Troll, with Joanna Myers as Maria Staples, Norman Jones as Sir Robert Peel, and Elizabeth Bell as Mrs. Gascoigne. Peter Jeffrey was Colonel Rowan, and Killian McKenna, Richard Mayne. Ian Lindsay was John Staples, Alan Barker Caslett, and Timothy Bateson, Frederick Rowe. Other parts are played by Susan Sheridan, Donald Herdman, James Green, Elizabeth Kelly, and Fraser Carr. The singer was Martin Carthy. Peeler was directed by Janet Whittaker.
For Mr. Peel's new watchman will be far too strong to fear you.